I will ascend to the high places of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the depths of the pit. Isaiah 14:12-15. The divine counsel context is transparent. You've already seen much of the terminology in chapter 6 about divine gardens and mountains. The figure to whom the king of Babylon is being compared is a divine being fallen from heaven. He is called the morning star, son of dawn. The language takes us back to Job 38:7, where the sons of God were called morning stars. But the Hebrew terms in Isaiah 14:12 are different than those in Job 38:7. Morning star, son of dawn, is an English rendering of the Hebrew Hallel ben Shachar, which literally means shining one, son of the dawn. When we talked about Job 38:7 in chapter 3, I noted that morning stars were the visible bright stars seen on the horizon as the sun rose. Astronomers, ancient and modern, knew another celestial object that behaved the same way, an object so bright it could still be seen as the sun rose. That object was Venus. And so Venus, though a planet, became known to the ancients as the bright morning star. In essence, borrowing the language of Ezekiel 28, Isaiah portrays this particular divine being as hopelessly enamored of his own brilliance. So great was his arrogance that he declared himself above all the stars of God, Kochaveel, the other members of the divine council. That this shining one sought superiority over the other members of the divine council is indicated by the phrase, "Raise my throne," and his desire to sit on the mountain of assembly. That this mountain of assembly speaks of the divine council is clear from its location in Zaphon, the north, Zaphon, and the clouds. The seat language is familiar from Ezekiel 28:2, the seat of the gods. Isaiah 14 reads like an attempted coup in the divine council. Hillel ben Shachar wanted his seat in the divine assembly on the divine mountain to be above all others. He wanted to be like the Most High, Elyon, but there can be only one of those. It's no surprise that Hillel ben Shachar, the Shining One, meets the same end as the divine throne guardian in Ezekiel 28. In three places we see his fate. You've seen two of the verses already. Take note of the emphasis in bold. Sheol below is getting excited over you, to meet you when you come. It arouses the dead spirits for you, all of the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. How you have fallen from heaven, morning star, son of dawn. You are cut down to the ground, Eretz. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the depths of the pit. Isaiah 14:9, 12, and 15. The punishment of Hillel is to live in the realm of the dead. Hillel ends up in Sheol, the pit, Bor, brought down to the earth, Eretz, by God, the truly Most High. The table below expands on the one we began in the previous chapter. As we move forward, I'll add terms and verses to those from Ezekiel 28. I'll focus on divine counsel connections between that chapter and Isaiah 14 and Genesis 3, but will include references from elsewhere when appropriate. Chart: The Divine Counsel Context. Elim, Elohim, plural, with the English meaning gods, reflecting the concept council members, as seen in Genesis 3:5 and 22, Psalm 82:1 and 6, Ezekiel 28:2. Bene Elim, meaning sons of God. Bene Elohim, meaning morning stars, and reflecting the concept council members. And Kochave Boker and Kochave El, meaning stars of God, and Hillel ben Shachar, shining one, son of the dawn, all having the concept of shining appearance, as seen in Job 38:7, Psalms 29:1 and 89:6, Isaiah 14:13, and Ezekiel 28:13 as gems. Gan, meaning garden, with the concept of divine abode, council meeting place, as seen in Genesis 2, 8-10, and 15 and 16, Genesis 3, 1-3, 8, 10, and 23-24, and Ezekiel 28, 13. Ed, which means watery mist, Nahar, which means river, and Yamim, meaning seas, waters, which are descriptions of the well-watered garden of the council, as illustrated in Genesis 2, 6, and 10-14, Zion, Ezekiel 47, 1-12, the Jerusalem temple, and also Zechariah 14, 8, and Ezekiel 28, 2. Tzifon, meaning north, Yerketat Tzifon, meaning heights of the north, and Bamat, meaning heights, all containing the concept of mountain range where the divine council met, as seen in Psalm 48, 1 and 2, the Jerusalem temple, also Ezekiel 40, 2, and Isaiah 14, 13 and 14. Har, meaning mount or mountain, containing the concept of mountain range where a divine council met, as seen in Exodus 24, 15, Sinai, see also Psalm 68, 15 to 17, and Deuteronomy 33, 1 and 2, Isaiah 14, 13, and 27, 13, Zion, Ezekiel 47, 1 to 12, the Jerusalem temple. Aida, meaning assembly, Sod, meaning council, Moed, meaning meeting, and Moshav, meaning seat, governing, all containing the concept of the divine assembly, as seen in Psalms 82, 1, 89, 7, Isaiah 14, 13, and Ezekiel 28, 2. End chart. The Nahash of Genesis 3. The pivotal character of Genesis 3 is the serpent. The Hebrew word translated serpent is Nahash. The word is both plain and elastic. The most straightforward meaning is the one virtually all translators and interpreters opt for, serpent. When the Hebrew root letters, nun, chet, shin, are a noun, that's the meaning. But nun, chet, shin are also the consonants of a verb. If we change the vowels to a verbal form, recall that Hebrew originally had no vowels, we would have nochesh, which means the diviner. Divination refers to communication with the supernatural world. A diviner in the ancient world was one who foretold omens or gave out divine information, oracles. We can see that element in the story. Eve is getting information from this being. The consonants nun, chet, shin may also form an alternative noun, nahash, which is at times used descriptively, like an adjective. This term is used in place names outside the Bible and once within the Old Testament. 1 Chronicles 4:12 refers to Tehinnah, father of Nahash. The otherwise unknown Tehinnah is regarded in this verse as the founder of the city, Hebrew of Nahash. This city has yet to be securely identified by archaeologists. The phrase means the city of copper, bronze, smiths. Hebrew words like nechoshet, bronze, copper, are derived from this noun. Nahash was a place known for copper and bronze metallurgy. The option is interesting because copper and bronze are shiny when polished. In fact, the Old Testament uses nechoshet to describe divine beings. We have words with such elasticity in English, where meaning depends on the part of speech. For example, noun. Running is a good form of exercise. Verb. The engine is running on diesel. Adjective. Running paint is an eyesore. Sometimes writers, when they use a term, want their readers to think about all possible meanings and nuances. If I ask, how has your reading been? The reader is forced to think about all three. Do I mean the latest assignment? Noun. Am I wondering if you got the right glasses? Adjective. Or am I referencing the process? Verb. What I'm suggesting is that, since there are immediate clues in the story that the serpent is more than a mere snake, that he may be a divine adversary, the term Nahash is a triple entendre. The writer wants his reader to consider all possible nuances in their interpretive intellectual experience. All of them carry theological weight. Note. I am not arguing that Nahash should not be translated serpent. It is not the translation that matters, but the recognition that the story is not about a mere animal. The serpent is actually a divine being. Rather, I am suggesting that, to literate readers of the Hebrew Bible, the lemma Nahash would have, intentionally so, brought to mind other elements of the cognitive framework of the original readers. The dispensing of divine knowledge, the verb form, and luminescence, Nahash, is the same root as Nechushet, copper, bronze, in Biblical Hebrew. With respect to the latter, given the Babylonian Aramaic context for other portions of Genesis 1 to 11, see chapters 12 to 15 in this book, it is worth noting that the Aramaic, nun, chet, shin, also refers to copper, shining bronze, evoking the same sense of radiance or brilliance. End note. The serpent, Nahash, was an image commonly used in reference to a divine throne guardian. Given the context of Eden, that helps identify the villain as a divine being. The divine adversary dispenses divine information, using it to goad Eve. He gives her an oracle, or an omen. You won't really die. God knows when you eat, you will be like one of the Elohim. Lastly, a shining appearance conveys a divine nature. All the meanings telegraph something important. They are consistent with the imagery from Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Divine judgment. I tend to be sympathetic toward Eve. She all too often gets cast as stupid and naive. Given the divine counsel context of her status as God's imager and new member of his family, what the Nahash said to her had the ring of validity. Of course God wants us to be like the Elohim. We're all one family. We all represent the Creator, don't we? Why would we die? This doesn't excuse Eve or Adam. Their disobedience had dire consequences. But while the reason for God's judgment is transparent, the meanings of that judgment beg for some careful thought. Entire books have been written on the implications of God's response, so my thoughts will be very selective. Note. I prefer the term judgment to curse when it comes to God's response to Adam and Eve, reserving the term curse for the serpent. I agree with Wenham's assessment. It should be noted that neither the man nor the woman are cursed, only the snake and the soil are cursed because of man. The sentences on the man and woman take the form of a disruption of their appointed roles. End note. The curse levied at Adam did not supersede God's mandate to subdue the earth and take dominion, but it did make the task harder. The expulsion of humankind from Eden turned a glorious dominion mission into mundane drudgery. We know that God would take steps to restore his rule, and that descendants of Adam, especially one of them, Genesis 3:15, would be critical to that kingdom. The human yearning for utopia is interesting in this light. We seem to have an inner sense of need to restore something that was lost, but Eden cannot return on purely human terms. God's judgment of Eve is in some sense entwined with the curse of the Nahash. Eve would suffer intensified pain in childbirth. Genesis 3:16, I will multiply your pain. There is no indication that, had she borne children before the fall, Eve would have felt no pain at all. She was human, and it was important that she bear children since her childbearing would have some relationship to the destiny of the Nahash and his deed. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Genesis 3:15. The wording of Genesis 3:15 is veiled. For reasons that I'll make clear later, I believe prophecies like this that ultimately move in a messianic direction were deliberately cryptic. At the very least, the verse tells us that God was not done with humanity yet. The goal of his rule on earth, through humanity, would not be abandoned. A descendant of Eve would come forth who would someday undo the damage caused by the divine rebel, the Nahash. that this descendant is linked to Eve implies that the score will be settled through her bloodline. This human threat to the Nahash is fitting. The seduction to sin meant that Yahweh would have to be true to his word and eliminate humanity. The Nahash counted on the justice of God to eliminate his rivals. God was just in this regard. Elimination from Eden did indeed mean death, but not in the sense of immediate annihilation. God would see to it that their lives ended, but not before continuing his plan. Humanity would die, but it would also, at some point, produce a descendant who would ultimately restore God's Edenic vision and destroy the Nahash. Adam and Eve had contingent immorality prior to the fall. They had never-ending life, depending on certain circumstances. The imagery of Eden, home of the life-giver and its tree of life, convey the notion that so long as Adam and Eve ate from the tree of life, called Eden their home, and didn't do anything that resulted in mortal injury, they were truly human after all, they would live. Protected in their perfect environment, they could multiply and carry out their tasks as God's representatives on earth until the job was done. All of that goes by the wayside once they are removed from Eden. God even takes the extra step of preventing them from returning to Eden's tree of life. Had they access to it, they would have gone on living, despite what had happened. After the fall, the only way to extend the work of God's human council family was childbirth. Eve was redeemed through childbearing, 1 Timothy 2:15. So were the rest of us, in the sense that that is the only way God's original plan remained viable. Where there are no offspring, there can be no human imaging and no kingdom. But the judgment on Eve also tells us that the Nahash would have offspring as well. The rest of the biblical story doesn't consist of humans battling snake people. That's no surprise, since the enemy of humanity wasn't a mere snake. The Bible does, however, describe an ongoing conflict between followers of Yahweh and human and divine beings who follow the spiritual path of the Nahash. All who oppose God's kingdom plan are the seed of the Nahash. Many readers who still feel the urge to see only a snake in Eden would no doubt contend that the curse pronounced on the Nahash requires that. I disagree. Literal readings are inadequate to convey the full theological messaging and the entirety of the worldview context. Consider what happens to the Nahash against the backdrop of the judgment language found in Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14. Chart. Serpent, Shining One, Imagery and Punishment. The Hebrew term Nahash, with the English meaning serpent, noun, to use divination, give omens, verb, bronze, brazen, adjective, containing the concept of wordplay. Triple entendre, image of serpent, divine throne guardian, information from divine realm, divination, shining appearance associated with divinity, brazen, as seen in Genesis 3, 1 and 2, 4, and 13 to 14, and chat, meaning serpent, with the same concept, as in Ezekiel 28, 12, with silent mem. Hallel, and Ben Shachar, meaning Shining One, Son of the Dawn, containing the concept shining appearance associated with divinity, as seen in Isaiah 14:12 and Ezekiel 28:13, referring to gems. Yerad, meaning brought down, Gada, cut down, Shelach, cast down, containing the concept an expulsion from the divine presence, and former service role to Yahweh, as in Ezekiel 28:8 and 17, and Isaiah 14:11-12 and 15. Note: the Satan of Job 1-2 is not the Nahash of Eden. See the discussion in chapter 8. The divine rebel of Eden lost his role as Yahweh's throne guardian and consequently access to Yahweh's counsel, as will be noted in subsequent chapters. As Lord of the Dead, the Nahash, later called Satan in the New Testament, has claim over humanity through death, since human immortality in the presence of God was disrupted by human sin in Eden, necessitating redemption to once again be part of God's eternal family. End note. Eretz, earth, ground, abstractly, underworld realm of the dead, and Sheol, meaning Sheol, realm of the dead, with the concept of underworld, realm of the dead. Note, the Nahash of Genesis 3 is made to crawl on his belly, put on the ground under the feet of animals, Genesis 3:14, as seen in Ezekiel 28:17, Isaiah 14:9, 11-12, and 15. Rephaim, meaning Rephaim, the shades, the dead in the underworld, and Melachim, meaning kings, fallen enemies, with a concept of underworld occupants, as seen in Ezekiel 28:17 and Isaiah 14:9. End chart. The Nahash was cursed to crawl on its belly, imagery that conveyed being cast down to the ground. In Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14, we saw the villain cast down to the Eretz, a term that refers literally to the dirt and metaphorically to the underworld. The curse also had him eating dirt, clearly a metaphorical reference, since snakes don't really eat dirt as food for nutrition. It isn't part of the natural snake diet. The point being made by the curse is that the Nahash, who wanted to be most high, will be most low instead, cast away from God and the council to the earth, and even under the earth. In the underworld, the Nahash is even lower than the beasts of the field. He is hidden from view and from life in God's world. His domain is death. After the fall, though humankind was estranged from God and no longer immortal, the plan of God was not extinguished. Genesis 3 tells us why we die, why we need redemption and salvation, and why we cannot save ourselves. It also tells us that God's plan has only been delayed, not defeated, and that the human story will be both a tragic struggle and a miraculous providential saga. But the situation is going to get worse before it gets better. Chapter 12. Divine Transgression. After the ruination of Eden, the human story heads south in a hurry. That's to be expected. The curses that followed the events in the garden bound the fate of humanity together with the seed of the Nahash, all those who oppose the rule of God in either the earthly or the spiritual realm. The rule of God, known as Eden, would disappear, kept alive only through a fledgling humanity to whom God extended mercy. The seed of the Nahash is therefore literal, people and divine beings are real, and spiritual. The lineage is one of spiritual rebellion. This description has secure biblical roots. Jesus told the Pharisees, "You are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father," John 8:44, and called them serpents and offspring of vipers, Matthew 23:33. In 1 John 3, the Apostle John expressed the notion of spiritual seed, good or evil, manifesting itself in the human heart when he wrote, "The one who practices sin is of the devil, because the devil has been sinning from the beginning. For this reason the Son of God was revealed, in order to destroy the works of the devil. Everyone who is fathered by God does not practice sin, because his seed resides in him, and he is not able to sin, because he has been fathered by God. By this the children of God and the children of the devil are evident. Everyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, namely, the one who does not love his brother. For this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one and violently murdered his brother, and for what reason did he violently murder him? Because his deeds were evil, and the deeds of his brother were righteous." 1 John 3:8-12. This passage describes people whose lives are characterized by wickedness as children of the devil, a contrast to the spiritual children of God. This is a spiritual lineage, since the children of God have God's seed abiding in them, a reference to the Holy Spirit. Peter echoes the same thought in 1 Peter 1:23, where he describes these born again, literally born from above, as being born not as mortal offspring or seed, but of imperishable seed through the word of God. The language then points toward the spiritual, following Yahweh, or following the example of the original rebel, the Nahash. Interestingly, John mentions Cain specifically. Cain murdered Abel sometime after their parents were expelled from Eden, the point at which we've arrived in our exploration. Cain's spiritual father was the Nahash. They walked the same path. Things eventually got so bad that in Genesis 6:5 we read, "And Yahweh saw that the evil of humankind was great upon the earth, and every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was always only evil." But that verdict is preceded by four verses that describe a different kind of rebellion, a divine one. There were those in that realm who, as the Nahash had done, made a free choice that violated God's design and strategy for his rule on earth. In what remains of this chapter, we'll take a closer look at this divine transgression, focusing on how the account has been stripped of its supernatural features, and therefore its intended meaning, by most Christian interpreters. We'll continue the discussion in the two chapters that follow, where we'll examine how the original context and intent of the passage compels a supernatural interpretation, and then explore that interpretation's implications. Precursor to the Flood, Divine Rebellion. Genesis 6, 1-4 is one of those texts that many readers and pastors would rather skip. Not here. Its theological message is important. "And it happened that, when humankind began to multiply on the face of the ground, daughters were born to them. Then the sons of God saw the daughters of humankind, that they were beautiful, and they took for themselves wives from all that they chose. And Yahweh said, 'My spirit shall not abide with humankind forever, in that he is also flesh, and his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were upon the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of humankind, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty warriors that were from ancient times, men of renown.'" There are few biblical passages that raise as many questions as this one. Who are the sons of God? Are they divine or human? Who were the Nephilim? How do these verses relate to the human evil described in Genesis 6:5? Before we start tackling these questions and others, we need to learn how not to interpret this passage. Note: the questions listed here are addressed in this chapter and the next. Other questions include how to think about the sexual element of the story and how, if everyone but Noah and his family is wiped out by the flood, Nephilim could show up on the earth after the flood. Those questions will be addressed in chapter 23. End note. The Sethite Interpretation. This interpretation of Genesis 6, 1-4 is the most commonly taught in Christian churches, evangelical or otherwise. It has been the dominant Christian position since the late 4th century AD. In this approach, the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1-4 are merely human beings, men from the line of Seth, Adam and Eve's son who was born after Cain murdered Abel. Presumably, these four verses describe forbidden intermarriage between the godly men of Seth's lineage, sons of God, and the ungodly women of Cain's line, daughters of humankind. In this reading, everyone who lived on earth ultimately came from these two lines, both of them lines descended from Adam and Eve's children. In this way, the Bible distinguished the godly from the ungodly. Part of the rationale for this view comes from Genesis 4:26, where, depending on the translation, we read that either Seth or humankind began to call on the name of the Lord. Note: the verb form, began, is third masculine singular. Since the word Adam, which is often rendered mankind or humankind in modern translations, for example Genesis 1:26, does not actually appear in the verse, the most natural rendering would be that Seth began to call on the name of the Lord. If this is the case, then the Sethite view needs to extrapolate Seth's faith to only men from that point on, since it is the sons of God who must be spiritually distinct from the daughters of humankind. One way around this is to argue that Genesis 6, 1-4 describes godly Sethite men marrying ungodly, non-Sethite women. The passage, of course, never says that, and it presumes that, by definition, the only godly women on the planet were those related to Seth. Those who insert humankind into the verse, humankind began to call on the name of the Lord, undermine the Sethite view with that decision, as it would have humans from other lineages, not just that of Seth, calling on the name of the Lord. End note. The line of Seth was to remain pure and separate from evil lineage. The marriages of Genesis 6, 1-4 erased this separation and incurred the wrath of God in the flood. Exposing the deficiencies of the Sethite view isn't difficult. The position is deeply flawed. First, Genesis 4:26 never says the only people who called on the name of the Lord were men from Seth's lineage. That idea is imposed on the text. Second, as we'll see in the next chapter, the view fails miserably in explaining the Nephilim. Third, the text never calls the women in the episode daughters of Cain. Rather, they are daughters of humankind. There is no actual link in the text to Cain. This means that the Sethite view of the text is supported by something not present in the text, which is the very antithesis of exegesis. Fourth, there is no command in the text regarding marriages or any prohibition against marrying certain persons. There are no Jews and Gentiles at this time. Note. It is also misguided to argue that the Sethite view is valid because the writers and editors of the Torah were living under the law. There are near-relation marriages in the Genesis story prior to the Sinai legislation. For example, Abraham and Sarah had the same father, but different mothers, a forbidden sexual relationship in the Torah. In other words, the later legal backdrop of Sinai isn't being presumed elsewhere in Genesis, so it cannot be presumed as the backdrop for Genesis 6, 1-4. There simply is no support for condemning human intermarriage in the text. End note. Fifth, nothing in Genesis 6, 1-4, or anywhere else in the Bible, identifies people who come from Seth's lineage with the descriptive phrase, sons of God. That connection is purely an assumption through which the story is filtered by those who hold the Sethite view. A close reading of Genesis 6, 1-4 makes it clear that a contrast is being created between two classes of individuals, one human and the other divine. When speaking of how humanity was multiplying on the earth, the text mentions only daughters. Daughters were born to them. The point is not, literally, that every birth in the history of the earth after Cain and Abel resulted in a girl. Rather, the writer is setting up a contrast of two groups. The first group is human and female, the daughters of humankind. Verse 2 introduces the other group for the contrast, the sons of God. That group is not human, but divine. There are more deficiencies in this viewpoint than I will take time here to expose, but the point is evident. The Sethite hypothesis collapses under the weight of its own incoherence. Divinized human rulers. Another approach that argues the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1-4 are human suggests that they should be understood as divinized human rulers. A survey of the academic literature arguing this perspective reveals that it springs from the following. 1. Taking the phrase, sons of the Most High, in Psalm 82:6 as referring to humans, then reading that back into Genesis 6, 1-4. 2. Noting language where God refers to humans as his sons, which, it is argued, is parallel to ancient Near Eastern beliefs that kings were thought to be divine offspring, and 3, arguing that the evil marriages condemned in the verses were human polygamy on the part of these divinized rulers. We have already seen how the human view of the plural Elohim language in Psalm 82 fails. So that fundamental flaw need not be reiterated here, but there are other flaws in this approach. First, the text of Genesis 6 never says the marriages were polygamous. That idea must be read into the passage. Second, ancient parallels restrict divine sonship language to kings. Consequently, the idea of a group of sons of God lacks a coherent ancient Near Eastern parallel. The precise plural phrase refers to divine beings elsewhere in the Old Testament, not kings. Note: the divinized kingship view is also defended by contending that there are no examples in ancient Near Eastern materials of divine beings marrying human women, while there are examples of kings claiming mixed ancestry from gods and humans. This, of course, presumes Genesis 6, 1-4 is describing matrimonial unions. This is playing word games, since the marriage idea derives from English translations. The word translated wife is simply the normal plural for women, nashim. The biblical euphemisms of taking or going in to a woman are not exclusively used for marriage. They are also used to describe the sexual act outside a marriage bond. That is, taking a woman can describe an illicit sexual relationship, as can coming, going in to. The point of the language of Genesis 6, 1-4 is a sexual relationship, not matrimony. This objection is therefore a distinction without a difference. This view also fails logically. The objection about the lack of divine human marriages is aimed at eliminating the divine element from Genesis 6, 1-4, thus reducing the episode to purely human relationships, albeit with divine kings as focus. But on what logical basis would multiple marriages between kings and women bring the world into chaos, necessitating God's judgment in a catastrophic flood? End note. Third, the broad idea of human divine kingship elsewhere in the Old Testament is not a coherent argument against a supernatural view of Genesis 6. It was God's original design for his human children to be servant rulers over the earth under his authority as his representatives in the presence of his glory. Restoring the loss of the Edenic vision eventually involves creating a people known as Israel and giving them a king, David, who is the template for Messiah. In the final eschatological outcome, the Messiah is the ultimate Davidic king, and all glorified believers share that rule in a new global Eden. Note: the idea of believers ruling over nations must be read in the context of the reclamation of the nations disinherited by God in Deuteronomy 32, 8-9. See chapter 15 and the final chapter of this book. The eschatological portrayal of glorified human rulers in a global Eden is why Hosea 1:10 cannot be used to argue that the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1-4 are human. First, the phrase is not a precise parallel. Second, that passage must be viewed in the larger context of biblical theology. Hosea 1:10 is eschatological. It looks to a distant future time when the northern kingdom of Israel will be restored as the people of God. That eschatological event coincides with the ultimate glorification of believers who are and will be children of the living God, ruling and reigning with Yahweh as originally intended in a new global Eden. The fact that God will see his human family fulfill the original Edenic goal does not overturn the fact that God also has a divine family. At the last day, when human believers are glorified, the two families and councils merge. One family of God doesn't erase the other. End note. But it is flawed hermeneutically to read either ancient kingship or the glorification of believers back into Genesis 6. The reason is obvious. The marriages in Genesis 6, 1-4 corrupt the earth in the prelude to the flood story. A biblical theology of divinized human rulership in the restored Eden would not be corruptive and evil. In summary, the plurality of the phrase sons of God and the heavenly contexts of its use elsewhere show us there is no exegetical reason to exclude the occurrences of the phrase in Genesis 6:2 and 4 from the list of supernatural beings. What drives this choice is apprehension about the alternative. Peter and Jude. Peter and Jude did not fear the alternative. They embraced a supernatural view of Genesis 6, 1-4. two passages are especially relevant. But there were also false prophets among the people, and in greediness they will exploit you with false words, whose condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but held them captive in Tartarus with chains of darkness, and handed them over to be kept for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a proclaimer of righteousness, and seven others, when he brought a flood on the world of the ungodly, and condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction, reducing them to ashes, having appointed them as an example for those who are going to be ungodly, and rescued righteous Lot, worn down by the way of life of lawless persons in licentiousness, for that righteous man, as he lived among them day after day, was tormenting his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he was seeing and hearing, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials, and to reserve the unrighteous to be punished at the day of judgment, and especially those who go after the flesh in defiling lust, and who despise authority. 2 Peter 2:1-10. Now I want to remind you, although you know everything once and for all, that Jesus, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt the second time, destroyed those who did not believe, and the angels who did not keep to their own domain, but deserted their proper dwelling place, he has kept in eternal bonds under deep gloom for the judgment of the great day, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the towns around them indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, in the same way as these, are exhibited as an example by undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. Jude 5-7. Scholars agree that the passages are about the same subject matter. They describe an episode from the time of Noah and the flood where angels sinned. That sin, which precipitated the flood, was sexual in nature. It is placed in the same category as the sin which prompted the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. The transgression was interpreted by Peter and Jude as evidence of despising authority and the boundaries of proper dwelling for the parties concerned. All those elements are transparent in Genesis 6, 1-4. There is simply no other sin in the Old Testament that meets these specific details, and no other angelic sin at all in the Old Testament that might be the referent. Note: some interpreters imagine a pre-fall rebellion of angels that might fit with 2 Peter. The Bible records no such event. The closest one comes to it is in Revelation 12:7-9. Not only is Revelation the last book of the Bible written, which means it cannot be the referent for 2 Peter, but Revelation 12:7-9 associates the war in heaven with the first coming of the Messiah, not events before the flood. There is no biblical evidence for a pre-fall angelic rebellion. The idea comes from Milton's Paradise Lost, not the Bible. End note. The punishment for the transgression, however, is not mentioned in Genesis 6:1-4. Peter has the divine sons of God held captive in Tartarus in chains of darkness until a time of judgment. Note: the phrase held captive in Tartarus in 2 Peter 2:4 is the translation of a verb lemma, tartarao, that points to the term from classical Greek literature for the destination of the divine Titans, a term that is also used of their semi-divine offspring. The terminology clearly informs us that, for Peter and Jude, an anti-supernaturalist interpretation of Genesis 6:1-4 was not in view. End note. Jude echoes the thought and clarifies the judgment as the day of the Lord, the great day. These elements come from Jewish literature written between our Old and New Testaments, the Second Temple period, that retell the Genesis 6 episode. The most famous of these is First Enoch. That book informed the thinking of Peter and Jude. It was part of their intellectual worldview. Note: this sort of thing is common in human experience. For example, anyone who has read John Calvin's Thoughts on Predestination or a dispensationalist's take on prophecy will find it next to impossible to eliminate that material from their thinking while reading, respectively, the book of Romans or Revelation. First Enoch and other works are part of the thinking of Peter and Jude because they were well known and taken seriously by contemporaries. The content of 1 Enoch shows up elsewhere in these epistles. It is obvious to those who study all these texts, especially in Greek, that Peter and Jude knew 1 Enoch very well. Scholars have devoted considerable attention to parallels between that book and the epistles of Peter and Jude. End note. The inspired New Testament writers were perfectly comfortable referencing content found in 1 Enoch and other Jewish books to articulate their theology. Note. None of this means 1 Enoch should be considered inspired. It shouldn't, and wasn't. A handful of leaders in the early church gave it that status, and those who did eventually abandoned the idea. End note. These observations are important. All Jewish traditions before the New Testament era took a supernatural view of Genesis 6, 1-4. Note. The well-known texts of 1 Enoch have the offenders of Genesis 6 as divine. The sons of God are called watchers in 1 Enoch, a term that, as our next chapter shows, derives from a Mesopotamian context, and their offspring as giants. 1 Enoch connects this to demonology in that when a giant was killed, its watcher spirit is referred to as a demon. Hence, in Genesis 6, divine-human cohabitation is the answer to where demons come from in Second Temple Jewish thinking. There are several other Second Temple Jewish texts that take the same perspective, and none that oppose it to my knowledge. For instance, several Dead Sea Scrolls refer to demons as bastard spirits. Another scroll refers to demons in column 2, 3, and then later calls the demons offspring of man and the seed of the holy ones. See the companion website for those texts. It is a clear indication of how Second Temple Jews understood Genesis 6, 1-4, which was in turn based on a grasp of the original polemic context of Genesis 6, 1-4. See chapter 13 for more on that context. End note. In other words, they were in line with 2 Peter and Jude. The interpretation of the passage, at least with respect to its supernatural orientation, was not an issue until the late 4th century AD when it fell out of favor with some influential church fathers, especially Augustine. But biblical theology does not derive from the church fathers. It derives from the biblical text, framed in its own context. Scholars agree that the Second Temple Jewish literature that influenced Peter and Jude shows intimate familiarity with the original Mesopotamian context of Genesis 6, 1-4. For the person who considers the Old and New Testament to be equally inspired, interpreting Genesis 6, 1-4 in context means analyzing it in light of its Mesopotamian background as well as 2 Peter and Jude, whose context utilizes supernatural interpretations from Jewish theology of their own day. Filtering Genesis 6, 1-4 through Christian tradition that arose centuries after the New Testament period cannot honestly be considered interpreting Genesis 6, 1-4 in context. Our next step is to build on what we've learned. In the next chapter, we'll take a closer look at how the ancient contexts of Genesis 6, 1-4 demand a supernatural outlook for the passage. Doing so will enable us to understand its message and role in the larger biblical narrative. Chapter 13. The Bad Seed. In the last chapter, we learned that New Testament writers partook of the intellectual climate of their own Jewish community, a community that flourished in the period between the Old and New Testament. It might seem unnecessary to mention this, given the enthusiasm many biblical readers have today for tapping into the Jewish mind to understand the words of Jesus and the apostles. When it comes to Genesis 6, 1-4, though, that enthusiasm often sours, since the result doesn't support the most comfortable modern Christian interpretation. The truth is that the writers of the New Testament knew nothing of the Sethite view, or of any view that makes the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1-4, humans. Our goal in this chapter is to revisit the passage and dig deeper. When we take it on its own terms, we can determine its character and meaning. The Ancient Near Eastern Context. That Genesis 1-11 has many connections to Mesopotamian literature is not disputed by scholars, evangelical or otherwise. The story of creation, the genealogies before the flood itself, and the Tower of Babel incident, all have secure connections to Mesopotamian material that is much older than the Old Testament. Genesis 6:1-4, too, has deep Mesopotamian roots that, until very recently, have not been fully recognized or appreciated. Jewish literature, like 1 Enoch, that retold the story, shows a keen awareness of that Mesopotamian context. This awareness shows us that Jewish thinkers of the Second Temple period understood correctly that the story involved divine beings and giant offspring. That understanding is essential to grasping what the biblical writers were trying to communicate. Genesis 6:1-4 is a polemic. It is a literary and theological effort to undermine the credibility of Mesopotamian gods and other aspects of that culture's worldview. Biblical writers do this frequently. The strategy often involves borrowing lines and motifs from the literature of the target civilization to articulate correct theology about Yahweh and to show contempt for other gods. Genesis 6:1-4 is a case study in this technique. Mesopotamia had several versions of the story of a catastrophic flood, complete with a large boat that saves animals and humans. They include mention of a group of sages, the Apkalus, possessors of great knowledge in the period before the flood. These Apkalus were divine beings. Many Apkalus were considered evil. Those Apkalus are integral to Mesopotamian demonology. After the flood, offspring of the Apkalus were said to be human in descent, in other words, having a human parent, and two-thirds Apkalu. In other words, the Apkalus mated with human women and produced quasi-divine offspring. The parallels to Genesis 6:1-4 are impossible to miss. The two-thirds divine description is especially noteworthy, since it precisely matches the description of the Mesopotamian hero Gilgamesh. Recent critical work on the cuneiform tablets of the Epic of Gilgamesh has revealed that Gilgamesh was considered a giant who retained knowledge from before the flood. Other connections. In the Mesopotamian flood story found in a text now known as the Era Epic, the Babylonian high god Marduk punishes the evil Apkalus with banishment to the subterranean waters deep inside the earth, which were known as Apsu. The Apsu was also considered part of the underworld. Marduk commanded that they never come up again. The parallels are clear and unmistakable. The banishment of these sinister divine beings to beneath the earth is significant. In the last chapter, I noted that this element of the story found in 2 Peter and Jude is not found in the Old Testament. The presence of this item in books like 1 Enoch, and subsequently in the New Testament, is a clear indication that Jewish writers between the Testaments were aware of the Mesopotamian context of Genesis 6:1-4. Note. As we saw in the previous chapter, 2 Peter 2:4 has the guilty divine beings imprisoned in Tartarus. This Greek word is the precise term used in classical Greek myths of ancient titans and giants. The two groups are different, but also conflated by classical Greek writers. However, both groups were divine in origin in Greek mythology. For our purposes, Peter's word choice here points very specifically to the divine nature of the sons of God in Genesis 6:1-4. End note. There are two other features to highlight in our discussion before we discuss what it all means. Sons of God, Watchers, Sons of Heaven, Holy Ones. The divine transgression before the flood is retold in several Jewish texts from the intertestamental period. At least one has the divine offenders coming to earth to fix the mess that was humankind, to provide direction and leadership through their knowledge. They were trying to help, but once they had assumed flesh, they failed to resist its urges. The more common version of events, one with a more sinister flavor, is found in 1 Enoch 6-11. This is the reading that informed Peter and Jude. The story begins very much like Genesis 6. And when the sons of men had multiplied, in those days, beautiful and comely daughters were born to them. And the watchers, the sons of heaven, saw them and desired them. And they said to one another, Come, let us choose for ourselves wives from the daughters of men, and let us beget for ourselves children. The account has the watchers descending to Mount Hermon, a site that will factor into the biblical epic in unexpected ways. Watcher, the English translation of the Aramaic ir, is not new to us. In an earlier chapter about how God and his council participate together in decision-making, we looked at part of Daniel 4, one of the sections of Daniel written in Aramaic, not Hebrew. Daniel 4 is the only biblical passage to specifically use the term watcher to describe the divine holy ones of Yahweh's council. Note: In Jewish literature from the era of Daniel through the Second Temple period, watcher is a common term for the heavenly sons of God. End note. The geographical context of Daniel is, of course, Babylon, which is in Mesopotamia. The offspring of the watchers, sons of God, in 1 Enoch, were giants. Some fragments of 1 Enoch among the Dead Sea Scrolls give names for some of the giants. Other texts that retell the story and are thus related to 1 Enoch do the same. The most startling of these is known today by scholars as the Book of Giants. It exists only in fragments, but names of several giants, offspring of the watchers, have survived. One of the names is Gilgamesh, the main character of the Mesopotamian Epic of Gilgamesh. Figurines of Apkallus, the Mesopotamian counterparts to the sons of God, are known through the work of Mesopotamian archaeologists. They were buried in rows of boxes as part of foundation walls for Mesopotamian buildings to ward off evil powers. These boxes were referred to by Mesopotamians as Matsare, which means watchers. The connection is explicit and direct. The Nephilim. One of the great debates over Genesis 6, 1-4 is the meaning of the word Nephilim. We've seen from the Mesopotamian context that the Apkallus were divine, mated with human women, and produced giant offspring. We've also seen that Jewish thinkers in the Second Temple period viewed the offspring of Genesis 6, 1-4 in the same way, as giants. Any analysis of the term Nephilim must account for, not ignore or violate, these contexts. Interpretation of the term Nephilim must also account for another Jewish phenomenon between the Testaments. Translation of the Old Testament into Greek. I speak here of the Septuagint. The word Nephilim occurs twice in the Hebrew Bible, Genesis 6:4 and Numbers 13:33. In both cases, the Septuagint translated the term with Gigas, giant. Given the backdrop we've covered, it would seem obvious that Nephilim ought to be understood as giants. But many commentators resist the rendering, arguing that it should be read as fallen ones, or those who fall upon, a battle expression. These options are based on the idea that the word derives from the Hebrew word nun, pe, lamed, nephal, to fall. More importantly, those who argue that Nephilim should be translated with one of these expressions rather than giants do so to avoid the quasi-divine nature of the Nephilim. That in turn makes it easier for them to argue that the sons of God were human. In reality, it doesn't matter whether fallen ones is the translation. In both the Mesopotamian context and the context of later Second Temple Jewish thought, their fathers are divine, and the Nephilim, however translated, are still described as giants. Consequently, insisting that the name means fallen produces no argument to counter a supernatural interpretation. Despite the uselessness of the argument, I'm not inclined to concede the point. I don't think Nephilim means fallen ones. Note: The translation fallen ones is based on a characterization of the behavior of the giants, not on any passage that informs us this is what Nephilim means. One Dead Sea Scrolls text says that the watchers fell from right standing with God and that their offspring followed in their footsteps. Note that while the verb nephal appears in this verse, the word Nephilim does not. That is, the fallen state is not attributed to the name itself. The word Nephilim occurs only twice in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Neither instance makes a connection to any behavior. In fact, no explanation of the term is ever offered.